Welcome to the All About Alts podcast, where we explore the world of alternative investing to help you find financial independence. Join our host, Newview Trust's president, Jason DeBono, as he covers a variety of topics with different guest speakers to discuss tax and alternative investing strategies. It is never too late to start taking control of your financial future, and we are so excited for you to be joining us for this opportunity to hear from some of the best in the business.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the All About Alts podcast. I am your host, Jason DeBono. I am joined today with the mad scientist of multifamily. Many of you guys know him, probably seen him speak or heard him on other podcasts, Mr. Neil Bawa. How are you, sir?
Great to be on with you, Jason. I'm looking forward to an interesting, invigorating discussion.
Yeah, it's going to be fun today. You know, we talk a lot about assets and asset classes, but I love that you're a self-proclaimed, you know, data nerd and you love digging into the numbers. I think we tend to maybe overlook some of those or we tend to kind of just scratch the surface on a couple numbers and let those numbers start to tell the story. So I'm pumped to kind of dig in and really understand what these numbers are telling us and not just, you know, what you can read in most reports, but really digging into some of the more unique type data. So more to come on there. When you're not crunching numbers and figuring out all the equations for the ins and outs of real estate, you do manage a nearly $700 million portfolio across 10 states. You're both a buyer and a builder. Let's start there. How'd you get into that side of, how'd you get into multifamily? How'd you get into, you know, you're a tech background. How'd you make that leap?
Taxes. So the answer, the one word answer is taxes. In 2003, I was running a company that we had grown from 10 employees to hundreds of employees. The company was cash flowing. We were making lots of money. I live in Taxifornia, so I was paying, 50%+ of my income in taxes. And our founder, the senior partner in the firm, I was a junior partner, technology firm, said, hey, let's build a campus. And so as I went through the process of building a campus, so, most of your listeners, they start with a flip or they start with a buy and hold single family. My first experience of real estate was in helping to build a 27,000 square foot campus from scratch. So trial by fire. I was horrified and terrified all the way through it because I was working a 12-hour day tech job. And in the evening, we were working on architectural design, zoning, permitting, and construction. But it all worked out in the end. No investors, no one else's money. It was just our money, the company's money. And we built it. And I was stunned, absolutely shocked by what that can do when you have depreciation coming from a real estate asset that size and how much it knocks your salary down by. The difference was mind-boggling. It was absolutely astonishing to me and changed my life. And as a result of that, I started basically keeping more money, right? It's not what you make, it's what you keep. And I was now keeping a lot more. And that pile of money was growing and growing and growing. So my timing was perfect. By the time the pile had grown large enough so that it was burning a hole in my pocket, it was 2008. And so in 2008, I started to use, I'm a data scientist by profession, so computer science is my major. Network engineering was my trade, but data science is really the key area of focus. And so I decided I'm going to apply data science to real estate. Why can't I apply it to real estate if I can apply it to technology? So I basically paid a Ukrainian hacker to spider dozens of different websites, including the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which I got in trouble for because I received a call from the FBI saying you're crashing our website. So we had to slow our spider down, and so we gathered that information. We put it into a system. And what the system told us, and very technical, but I'm going to give you the bottom line. The system said that this may be the greatest time in the last 100 years to buy real estate. So I'm an idiot in these kinds of things. I just went around telling everybody that. And people basically were looking at me like I'm the greatest moron of all time. In 2008, I'm going around telling people that this may be the greatest time, to buy real estate in 100 years. And everyone's like, don't you know what's going on out there? I mean, people don't even know the value of real estate. I'm like, no, you don't understand. Everything that you're buying is 30, 40, 50% below replacement cost. Don't you understand that? And let me show you this amazing statistical analysis and data analytics big tool that I put in. And nobody even, like, people were just tuning out when I would say those words, right? They're like, I don't care, this guy's an idiot. And so my own family banned me from going to, you know, events because they felt like I would infect the other people in the family. And so I decided I'm just going to use my own money and prove everybody wrong. I was very confident in my data. So I started to basically use the data. And I found a city in California. I live in California. This city is 144 miles away in Madera, California. And basically, that city had dropped by 70% from peak, right? So the whatever the 2005, 2006 peak was, it had dropped 70%. So it was far below replacement value, way below replacement value. And so a big part of my, you know, career and sort of the fame that sort of developed over that time was my finding Madera and going out there and buying a property every month. And we can talk about how I did that because obviously loans were very hard to find. And you know, so I had to do some radical, interesting things like hacking 30 different websites to get my properties in Madera leased up. But that's a different story. But bottom line is that's what got me into real estate. So it really, coming back to your question, was taxes really got me into real estate because I realized it isn't about what you make, it's about what you keep. And I'll end that this section and by saying this, I haven't paid taxes since 2014, and that's legal, right? On millions and millions and millions of dollars every year.
Well, that's, I think what, when people understand that real estate is certainly an investment vehicle, but it's so much more than that, right? It's a store of money. It's a tool to lever. It's a tool to mitigate taxes. There's so many things and you have so many types of real estate that play into that. So let's kind of talk about that 2008, right? You're running around and everyone wants to put you in the loony house because why is this guy telling us to go do it? Yet at some point people were like, wait a minute, Neil's onto something here. And maybe he was right. How did that play out? When did that realization maybe hit for some of those people that had kind of maybe shunned you, or just said, get out of here. And, you know, the numbers don't matter. You know, how long did it take for that realization to kind of see the light of day?
Well, it actually took a while, but what I did in 2008, I was like, these people don't understand my language, that, you know, I'm a data scientist. They don't understand me. I need to find other people like me. So I basically decided to open a meetup group inside of my corporate campus. So I'd be, you know, these huge conference rooms with projectors and seats. And I was like, let me open a meetup group. And I'm going to basically open a meetup group for real estate data science. And it had a horrible, like really technical name. So first meeting, four people show up. They're all nerds like me, but like two work for Apple, one works for Google, one works for HP. And it's like, you know, instead of doing a PowerPoint presentation, I actually sit down and start showing them my data and what it really means and how I'm ranking cities in the United States. And this meetup, which is supposed to basically, you know, be from 7 to 8 p.m., goes on beyond midnight, right? With these four people. And by the end of it, everyone is ready. Everyone's making huge amounts of money, but we're also paying huge amounts of taxes. So everyone's like, let's go do this. So I'm like, okay, well, let's, you know, jump in our car. We go to Madera, California. We discover that the properties are 50% below replacement value. But the problem is there's thousands and thousands of empty brand new properties in Madera, California, because Kaufman and Broad had invited all these farm workers to basically sign using you know, stated income loans. Remember that you know, mess? Oh, yeah. And so as a result, all those people had left in these properties, entire sections of the city were empty with these gorgeous, gorgeous four-bedroom properties with stonework. Nobody had ever lived in them. And they were selling them for 90K, and their replacement value, that the cost to build them back then was about 200K. So I was like, the math here is inescapable. These are going to go up in value, but I don't know when. But the challenge is that I wasn't rich enough to just pay cash. I needed, you know, they were like, you have to pay them, you know, pay me in cash. And it's like, yeah, but then I need to refinance it. Well, to get refinanced, you need to get a tenant. And so we jumped back in our cars, me and my friends. We drove to Fresno, which is 20 minutes away from Madera, went into a realtor's office, deliberately bought an old single family home in Fresno. And this was like 25 years old. So not brand new, not as good looking, only had three bedrooms, not four. And then I called my Ukrainian hacker guy who was doing all the data gathering for me and said, this old property, I want it on 30 different websites. And he's like, why? You only have one property. Why do you need hundreds or thousands of tenant leads? And I said, trust me, right? And he's like, so are you going to take all these phone calls? Or like your phone's going to be ringing off the hook. It's like, no. I'm going to call a person. I went to Upwork. I hired a person in the Philippines for $5.50 an hour. Her name was Julianne. I basically told Julianne, everybody that calls you, tell them that this property is now rented. But 20 miles away in Madeira, we have brand new 4-bedroom properties. And we have many of them, right? If you simply go to Madeira, check the properties out and come back, we will give you a $50 Amazon gift card. And 10 people that called her thought that she was part of some scam, especially because she sounded Filipino, and hung up on her. But the 10th person is like, sure, I'm interested. Send me some pictures. And she would send pictures out. She would send videos. She would send a video of me. And then people are like, oh, sure. Okay. What's the worst that can happen? I go to Madeira and there's nothing there. Right. And so people are like, yeah, $50 Amazon gift card. I'll go. And so they would go to Madeira. And then we would show them a property that we didn't own yet, because we had a deal with the bank to say, if we can get a tenant in there, we would pay cash the next day. Right. And so they would go in, they would fall in love with the property because these were brand new, gorgeous properties, right? And they would say, oh yeah, I mean, the rent here is only like $1,100, because the rent for this property in Fresno was $2,200. They were saving 50% with a 22-minute commute. And so as you can imagine, we would fill a property, pay cash. The next day, we would close on the property and we would rent that property out, and then we'd be able to refinance and basically get $70,000 back. And we would repeat the process, one property a month, every single month, 2008, 2009, 2010. And as we're doing this, we're realizing that our cash flow is going completely insane, right? It's just insane, insane amounts of cash flow. By the way, those properties that were $1,100 then, they're $2,800 now, right? I'd never sold them because of something known as depreciation. If I sell these properties, my depreciation recapture is going to kill me. So now those are $2,800 and the properties are all $400,000 each, and I was buying them at 90. And so I decided this works. This clearly, absolutely, 100%, there's no way in hell any math professor would ever tell me that what I'm doing is not an incredible return on investment. So I need to tell this story to other people. And so I started holding more meetup groups. I renamed my meetup to a nicer name called Location Magic, right? How to find the best cities in America to invest in. Now, 10 people are coming to a meetup, soon 50, soon 100, then it's standing room only. Then people are actually coming to me to say, we can sponsor your meetup so you can get food. And then before I know it, people are calling me from conferences across the United States saying, aren't you that nerd guy that has this thing called Location Magic? So I'm like, maybe I need to take this and build it into a course, because it was a set of principles, right? How do you compare cities? Where do you figure which city is better than the other? So I built the course and I stuck it on a website called udemy.com. So that's udemy.com. So you can type in udemy.com/Neil Bau and you'll see the course. And I was like, maybe 100 people, 200 people a year will take the course there. And I had no, at that point, I was just looking to share. I had no product to sell, no service, no education. It was just like, let's give this stuff away for free because I'm liking the ecosystem of people, these nerds that are developing that really like real estate. And so it was just fun. And this is 2009, 2010, 2011. So I put the course up there and it just goes supernova, Jason, right? So right now, if you go type in udemy.com/Neil Bau and click on the course, you'll notice that there's 13,000 people taking the course. It is the highest ranked real estate course on Udemy. There's hundreds of courses on Udemy. There's over 1,000 people with 5-star reviews on a free course. And this course is 2 hours long. And it basically tells them how to rank cities in the United States for real estate. People have loved this course. And I get thank you notes every day. I still answer all of the questions that they have personally. So I spend about 30 minutes every week answering their questions. And each year I update the course, because the way the course is designed, it's for a specific year. So once in a year, we update the course. And so this community started to develop around me in 2011, 12, 13. And I'm still running my tech company. And then I sell my tech company in 2013 and end up with a massive tax bill. And the only way to get rid of that tax bill was not just to invest in real estate, but to invest in real estate as a general partner, where you get additional depreciation. So on the same piece of land, you get more depreciation as a general partner than you'd get as a limited partner, because you're also getting some of the depreciations that the limited partners get. You get a piece of their pie as well. And so that's what started my journey. So I think late 2013, early 2014 is the first time I actually took investor money. But it was really easy, Jason, because a community had already developed. I had thousands of people's attention. They knew that for years I was giving my data science away. So when I called on them for the first time to invest with me, it was extremely simple, extremely fast.
Yeah, what a, you know, it's amazing how I love talking to people about how they got started and their stories. And, you know, you hear so many different things and it's amazing. You know, you didn't really start this to get where you are today. A lot of people, they do start, you know, I left my career. I, you know, went into real estate because I wanted to grow. And you were kind of like, I like my tech career. I just like to apply the tech and I happen to apply it to real estate. And here we are. And what an amazing growth, especially on the education side. You know, that's a chance to help others learn and get into this business. So let's fast forward. You know, here we are, 2024. What, you know, you sold your company 10 years ago. Are you doing anything in tech? Is real estate full time? What keeps Neil busy today?
I am a angel investor at Plug and Play, which is the largest startup accelerator in the United States. So I keep myself, you know, in tune with angel investing and with technology. Technology is my first love. I tell people I am not a real estate person. I'm a technologist that is investing in real estate and feel, you know, I invest in lots of things that have nothing to do with real estate. Artificial intelligence, crypto, all kinds of things that catch my fancy. I just find real estate to have taxation benefits that none of these other areas have. So I stick with real estate as quote unquote the day job. But what I like most about my day job is I have the time and I have an army in the Philippines that you know I've used to automate most of my business. Also an army in the US, but a bigger army in the Philippines. And that gives me time. And I use that time to publish a great deal of real estate data. My rule has always been never sell this data, never offer a subscription, always give it away completely for free, don't ask for anything back. And some small percentage of that community will at some point in the future join you for your projects whenever you need money for your projects. And it's worked brilliantly. We've had about 50,000 people in our community. 1,000 of those have become investors with us, have given us money. The remaining 49,000 are just using the data and I get thank you emails and that's what I get out of it. And so that idea, that concept of being like a Wikipedia of real estate information, that's germinated in 2009. It's really developed over time into this website called Multifamily University or multifamilyu.com. And if you go in there, you'll see dozens and dozens of interesting data science courses. We've got all kinds of stuff, and not just on real estate. We've got the standard courses on student housing, built to rent, multifamily, you know, all the other kinds of asset classes in real estate. But then we've also got interesting stuff on impact of climate change on real estate, impact of artificial intelligence on real estate. You know, we've got stuff that's relevant to COVID when COVID came out in 2020. So it's just interesting data science things that catch our attention and we tie it back to real estate whenever we can. But sometimes it's just, hey, here's something interesting. Would you like to come to a webinar and discuss?
I love it. Well, thank you for continuing to be that resource. I think people, you know, they need data. And sometimes not everybody can even read and process data, let alone pull it and put it in a way that makes sense. So thank you for continuing to help build that community. I think we all want, you know, more informed people out there. I want to talk about the data, and I want to dig into that. And we're gonna do that right after our quirky questions. We're gonna throw you on the hot seat here, Neil, and see what's behind one of our envelopes here. So Amy is coming around with them. I think we're gonna go the top one today. Thank you, Amy. As always, if you have quirky questions, you guys want to continue to submit, send them to allaboutalts@newviewtrust.com. All right, Neil. You're on the hot seat. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Theme park or a water park?
Always, always water park. The kids love it. Theme parks get old. Water parks never do, even for adults.
Okay. As a Florida guy, and I think maybe there's some truth to that being on the California side as well. You have better weather, I think, most of the year than we do. That water's critical in the summertime. You know, we're here in Central Florida, and I it amazes me how many people say, oh, I'm bringing my, you know, kids to Disney in July. And I'm thinking, in July, you know, take them out of school for a couple of days and bring them in February. It's half the price and it's comfortable. You don't want to wait in line for 2 hours in 98 degree weather. But
also because theme parks are now over $100 per ticket, water parks are usually under $50.
Yeah, well, you haven't been to a theme park in Florida in a while. They're approaching $200 a day. Oh, it's I don't know how. I mean, we live here and it's unaffordable. I don't know how you pack up a family of four and put them on an airplane and hotels. Yeah. And yeah, it's unbelievable. But they'll keep driving prices up until people stop showing up. All right. If you could live in any home from a sitcom or TV show, what home are you living in?
That's super interesting. What was that show? I can't remember the name of the show. It's been a while. I don't know. I don't have any particular home that I've liked in the sitcoms. They're all kind of very standard in design. So I will simply say, I'll pick one from a movie instead from a sitcom. I liked Tony Stark's penthouse in The Avengers with the big A. I'd love to live there.
Yeah, I think any one of Tony Stark's properties probably meet that criteria, because not only are they gorgeously set up and in cool locations, but can you imagine the way these things are outfitted? No, yeah, I like that. I do like that. All right. If you had to be a candle scent, what candle scent are you going to be?
That's an interesting one. Is it okay to pick fruits? Strawberry.
Yeah. You can get a candle that smells like anything today. So I think you're open-ended here, Neil.
Strawberry. I like the fact that there's a fruitiness to the scent. I like fruity scents.
Okay. Strawberry it is. You, my friend, are off the hot seat. So
yeah.
Woo. Always fun. Never quite know what you're going to get, both in question and answer form. So thank you to those that continue to submit questions. We always appreciate it. As much as I love the show itself, it always gives me good joy to open that envelope and read those out. So thank you, Neil, for hopping on the hot seat. Let's get back to the data, right? I mean, you know, we talk about data, and it is amazing, because there's data so much to so many people, right? And data is absolutely critical in decision making. But you're pulling data. I think probably, I don't know if it's unconventional, but I think for most real estate investors, you know, there's 3, 4, 5 points of data tops, right? And you're kind of saying, hey, let's get to 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 points of data. What's the data telling you? I know you kind of look at it year by year. We're in Q2 of 2024, at least at the time of recording. What's the data telling you, Neil? What are you seeing? And what's been... maybe kind of the bits or pieces of data that have just jumped off the page at you in the last few months?
Well, the most shocking pieces of data, the ones that I think are the most important, right? Data is always important, but my core belief is some pieces of data are much more important than others. So I'm going to give you those pieces of information. So in 2013, more than 50% of Americans could afford the median home. 2013. So reasonable, right? Half of America could afford a median home. And that number sort of slowly declined, but it was still at 45% the day before COVID hit. 45% of Americans could still afford a single family home. Today, that number is at 15%.
Wow.
So in a little over 4 years, we've gone from 45% of Americans being able to afford a median home to 15%. Basically, what this means is 1/7 of the families in America can afford a median home, 6/7 cannot. So the first thing that tells me is the last 4 years have been remarkably different. So, and I'll talk about what that means for investors. What does that mean for the country? But first, let's dig a little bit deeper into why we've gone from 45% to 15% in just 4 years. The first reason is home prices are up 44%. So in 4 years, home prices have gone up 44%. They really spiked in 21 and 22. And then since then, they've slowed down. But despite the fact that interest rates are more than double today, compared to a little over 2 years ago, despite that, home prices have not declined. Most people would think, yeah, with interest rates being, you know, in the 7.5% range for a 30-year fixed, you'd think that home prices would go down. No. Nationwide home prices in the last 12 months have increased by 6%. And even in super expensive metros where I, you know, like the place I live, San Francisco Bay Area, they've increased by 4%. So you'd think that San Francisco people are paying $2 million at 7.5%. That should crash the market. 4%. Maybe not 6%, but 4%. So home prices are going up. So the first reason for the lack of affordability is 44% increase in home prices, right? But the worst part is not the home prices. It's the mortgage rates, right? So interest rates were around 3.5% 2.5 years ago, and now they're at 7.5%. Now, what does that mean, really? Well, when you buy a home, the first thing you need to look at is your mortgage payment. So wouldn't it be nice to compare the mortgage payment one day before COVID with today's mortgage payment? Wouldn't that give you a true sense of the picture? Well, mortgage payments in the United States have increased by 111% in 4 years.
Wow.
So if a home costs $3,000 the day before, monthly payment was $3,000, today that monthly payment is around $6,700, right? That is a mind-blowing statistic, because when I compare it with the other most important statistic, how much have salaries gone up in the United States? Well, the answer is salaries in the United States have gone up 19.7%. So in 4 years, so roughly 5% a year. In the last 4 years, right? Which is fairly normal. They've actually been going up faster than normal because of inflation being high. So Americans got 20% more in salaries, but their mortgage is up 111%. Mm-hmm. And home prices are not declining, even though, you know, interest rates are, you know, all-time highs, because of the lock-in effect. Perfect example. I have a big mortgage at 1.75% fixed. And my mortgage is roughly $5,000 a month, including taxes and insurance. If I were to sell my home and buy it back for $1 more the next day, my $5,000 payment becomes $20,000 a month. So I'm locked in. I can't go anywhere. I can't sell. Well, more than 25 million American families are locked in at interest rates below 4%. And today, 7.5% is really the lowest that they could get. And so they're locked in, they're not moving, their homes are not in the marketplace. And so the total inventory of homes in the market in the United States is very low. And that's keeping prices from going down, right? So people are buying with cash, or they're buying with 50% down or 60% down. They're doing anything and everything they can to buy those homes. And that's keeping the prices from coming down. So bottom line is, the last 4 years have been nothing like the last 100 years. They have been absolutely astonishing. And America is becoming a renter nation. Remember, 15% of Americans can now afford the median home. 15%. Now, two-thirds of Americans currently live in their own home. Two-thirds. But those homes, most of them were purchased in, you know, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s. And less are being purchased now. So we are becoming a renter nation, and I don't think that that is going to change in any meaningful way unless we get ridiculous salary increases. Now, I don't expect that gap between the 111% increase in mortgage and the 20% increase, I think that will come down as rates come down. But I think it'll come down from 111 to 100 or 90 or 80. Even at 80, it's a 4x gap. Your mortgage is up 80%, your salary is up 20%. It's still a massive problem. And that is the biggest, most important number in real estate. And we can talk about what that means for investors and for the country. But I wanted to get those numbers out there so people can understand just how shockingly unaffordable America has become.
Well, you know, you bring up a point, and I live in real estate. You know, every day I work in this business. I see real estate. I'm an investor in real estate. And it's a prime example of how, you know, sometimes we read data and we let it tell the story, when in reality, you know, Neil, you just pointed out data that tells a different story than what I thought. You know, the home prices being up 44%, right? Everybody that touches real estate knows that. And while we know that mortgage rates are up, and while we know and we know and we know, I've never compared that to the actual mortgage rate of that home then versus today. And it's way worse than I thought it was. You know, a 44% increase in real estate in a short window of time does render a lot of homes unaffordable. But when you realize that it's not 44%, it's actually over 100% in terms of payments. I mean, you're talking about doubling the cost of homeownership, and you haven't even factored in certain states like Florida, where you've got massive insurance problems. And
huge. Florida insurance went up 51% in the last 12 months. 51%.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, my insurance on my house when I moved in 2021 was $1,400. I just got my renewal, honest to God truth, from $1,400 to, this is 21 to April of 2024, it's $9,800. Now, you know, compare that from a payment standpoint. Now, thankfully, I'm on the other side of the interest rate. But if somebody were to buy my house today, they're going to see that 100% increase in cost. And, you know, my insurance went from $100 a month to $800 a month. Yeah. So you've got another 7x in just cost on the insurance side of it. So let's talk about that, right? So the market, right? I guess it's a we, has created this unaffordability. And this word came up a lot in 2005 and 4 and even 6 and 7, right? It's unaffordable. And so there was all these initiatives. Well, for a lot of people, we become a renter community, right? So people go on to the rental side. Yet if we look at multifamily, right? Multifamily is facing some challenges of its own at a time when the single family market is actually pushing people to be renters. You would think this would be like skyrocketing the rental income on a multifamily dwelling, yet we've seen prices come down.
That's right.
You got to make sense of those numbers for me, Neil.
Sure. I think it's really straightforward. So when you buy a single family home, the vast majority are still non-investor related purchases, you know, people buying a home to live in. And that is an emotional purchase. If you're buying a home for $1 million and the home next to you, which is the same identical size, just sold for $1 million, your home's worth $1 million. Any bank will immediately use that as a comp and give you a loan as long as you can afford it. Multifamily doesn't really work like that. Multifamily is a business. When you buy a 200 unit apartment complex, I just bought a 194 unit apartment complex called Midtown Ridge. And Midtown Ridge, its price, I paid $29.6 million. It would have been about $38 to $39 million if I bought it in March 2022. So a little over 2 years ago, this property would have cost $8 million more to buy. You know what's cool is its income has actually gone up about 5%. Not a huge number, but gone up about 5% in those intervening 2 years. So the multifamily is valued based on a couple different things. Number one is its net operating income. So you get you're buying a multiple of net operating income. But the other thing that happens with multifamily is whenever interest rates go up, and as you can imagine, interest rates have doubled, right? So let's just use doubling as a good number, right? So we had some properties at 3%. Now those properties are at 6.5%, right? So if interest rates double, your mortgage payment is increasing. On the single family side, nobody's paying attention to the fact that mortgage payment has more than doubled. On the multifamily side, the lenders say, your mortgage payment is higher, so your debt coverage ratio is lower. Essentially, you're not able to cover your debt. I'm not going to give you that much of a loan. So what is happening in the multifamily industry is that for the same property with the same income, the banks are giving you 30, 40% less debt. Well, if you're going to get 30% or 40% less from the banks, the value of the property has to come down because you're not going to double the amount of equity or down payment that you're going to put in. You're going to put in the same down payment, right? 20%, 30%, whatever it may be. Well, that gap that has opened up with the banks giving you a lower loan means the value of properties has dropped. And so the same property with same or higher income compared to 2 years ago is now 25 to 30% cheaper. Because multifamily is a business and single family is an emotional investment. So for the first time in American history, we have seen the largest divergence between single family performance and multifamily performance. We've never seen a divergence this large. 2008, both went down, right? So multifamily went down, single family went down. But this is a divergence that's happening. And it's an extraordinary opportunity because the demand for multifamily is up. As you said, Jason, millions and millions of people who before COVID would have transitioned to their starter home are unable to transition. Where are they going? They're going to multifamily. So absorption rates of multifamily, which is a technical term for saying how many people want to be renters, is up. It's up big time. In every metro in the United States, absorption is up. But prices are down because banks don't care about demand. All banks care about is your mortgage payment has doubled. That means I'm going to give you a much smaller loan because I want to make sure you've got a cushion because multifamily is a business. So we have this opportunity where at the same time when we have record-breaking absorption on the multifamily side, we've also got prices dropping at the same level. There's one other thing that is causing prices to drop, and that is incoming supply. So imagine 2022. We were at the top of the world. Every property was going gangbusters. We were selling properties that we bought at $55,000 a door. We were selling them at four times that price or three times that price. Everyone was making money like crazy. And imagine developers. Wouldn't they be able to get money to fund their properties, right? Everyone is throwing money at them at, you know, cheap development loans, which were actually loans that would adjust if rates went up. But rates were low back then. Nobody cared. So developers started on an absolutely record amount of new multifamily in 2022. And guess when that inventory comes to the market? 2 years later, because it takes 2 years to build apartments. Well, now in 2024, we are delivering a massive amount of inventory. And that massive amount of inventory is keeping us from raising rents. So rents are only going up by 1.5%, where inflation's at 3.5%. So rents are actually, for the first time, we have this weird scenario where demand is through the roof, but rents, instead of being faster than inflation, which they normally tend to be, are slower than inflation. But that ends halfway through 2025. Because in 2023, with interest rates being so high, less developers started apartments. In 2024, even lesser are starting apartments. So this glut of incoming supply, which is based on all those low interest rates from early 2022, is going to end in the next 12 months. And the moment that glut ends, we're going to raise rents by 5, 6, 7%. In our world, if you raise rents by 3%, you can double investor money if you buy a good property in about 6 years. If you raise rents by 6%, you can double investor money in 3 years. So we're looking forward to this opportunity. Right now, we're just suffering and taking a beating from that incoming supply. We're, you know, not able to raise our rent, so we're tightly managing our property. Most people in multifamily are not distributing cash flow to investors this year. We're saying, hey, hang on, let's wait until next year. But this is the same opportunity that I saw in 2008, right? You have a divergence, increase, a massive multi-million family increase in absorption, and at the same time, a decline in prices by 25%. So today I am telling people, all my investors, most of my investors are bearish because of what happened in multifamily in the last 18 months. And I'm telling them, you're looking at the past to make future decisions. That's a terrible way to make decisions. Look at the math, understand the opportunity. And by the time you get comfortable, this opportunity will be gone. Because by the end of next year, when that supply glut ends, we raise our rents, multifamily prices will go straight back up to where they were. You know, that 25% decline is going to vanish. And so I'm very excited to be in the multifamily space right now. I'm not bullish about single family at this point of time. I don't think single family prices will decline, but I don't think that they're going to go up. So my prediction for single family simply is in the next 2 to 3 years, slight decline or plateau, but not an increase. They cannot increase with only 15% of Americans able to afford them.
Yeah, well, there's just so many different scenarios. One that comes into play, you know, and at the time of recording, the Fed is meeting, and so we'll get some more clarity soon. But maybe for context, right? You know, and you can correct these numbers if I've got them slightly off. But the market started to turn on the interest rate side, and once they flatlined, and there was, you know, I'll say the Wall Street bettors were betting on 6 rate decreases in 2024. Here we are in the beginning of May, and we haven't seen a single one. It sounds like higher for longer is kind of the new norm. That bet has gone from 6 to 2, you know, rate increases, where it's almost even money split between whether we'll have an increase or a decrease first, right? So we've kind of backpedaled, right? We've backpedaled all the way from the progress, I think, that was made around interest rates in January and February. And then, like I said, here we are in May. So let's turn and let's put your Fed hat on, Neil. And to be honest, you may be looking at more data than they are. And I probably, after hearing you talk, maybe trust the way you look at data a little more than they do. But what says you? What do you see in the market, understanding that you're not the Fed and Lord only knows what they will do? But what a 180. Are we going to go full circle, or are we going to pump the brakes? Are we going to see increases before the end of the year? And if that's all not enough, you got an election, that just pesky little presidential election that's coming up this year as well, which always throws everything out of whack on top of that. So I set the table so nicely for you for just a super easy answer here. What do you got for us?
I think that the Fed is underestimated in terms of how much data they look at and how well they follow it. I think most institutions in the United States are extraordinarily biased politically, so I don't trust their data. I actually do trust the data that comes out of the New York Fed and the Atlanta Fed and the St. Louis Fed. These people in Republican administrations do get more pressure, but in Democrat administrations, historically, they get less pressure. For example, if you remember Donald Trump making very, very threatening, aggressive tweets to the chairman of the Fed when he was president, Biden has not made any direct or indirect conversations about what the Fed needs to do. And the reason for that is his Treasury Secretary is Janet Yellen. Janet Yellen was the previous chairman of the Fed before the current chairman, Jerome Powell. So he understands and trusts that this lady knows both the upside and downside of being, pushing the Fed. My belief is the Fed is not under any pressure from anyone at this point of time. They're actually in a very sweet position. They have managed to get inflation down from 9 to 3. They've continued, obviously raised interest rates to shocking, heights, and they continue to take liquidity out of the market. Most people don't understand the Fed does two things, not one. One, they raise or increase or decrease interest rates. But there's a second, and that is quantitative tightening or easing. So the Fed had a balance sheet of $9 trillion. And each month they remove $90 billion of liquidity from the marketplace. Google this. With the exception of last year when the banks were failing, they stopped for a little while. But with the exception of that, they're continuously removing $90 billion every month from the liquidity in the United States. And that itself is placing pressure on the marketplace. So let me say this, and maybe I'll proven to be wrong. I don't see any reason why the Fed won't cut twice this year. And they may even cut three times this year. The Fed is data-driven. Inflation has stayed higher than they anticipated in the last 5 months, especially since January. So January to April, inflation has stayed higher than where they thought it would. And so they're saying, we thought we would cut by May. Now we're not going to cut. We might not even cut in July. We might wait until September. But I think we still get our two interest rate cuts because the direction of rate cuts has not changed. The timing has changed. Right? So if this is their slope, they're still saying this is our slope, but instead of starting here, we're going to start here. We're going to start later in the process. And that's what the Fed is saying. They're very consistent in their messaging. Also, the economy is clearly weakening. I am seeing, industrial go negative. I am seeing demand fall. So understand this, that when people say, well, the Fed has to raise interest rates more, that you don't understand this. Imagine this is my chest, right? Every time the Fed raises interest rates by 100 basis points, they're placing a 10-pound weight on my chest, okay? Every time they raise it. So now they've raised rates by 550 basis points, which means that 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 50, and 5. There's a 55-pound weight on my chest right now. And that doesn't even include what they're doing with quantitative tightening, which is even more weight on my chest. So the Fed, just by keeping rates at an extremely high level, is pushing the economy down every single month. They don't need to keep raising. 5.5% is a massive weight on the economy that's slowing things down. So the slowdown is just taking longer. What the Fed is saying, we will just cut when we feel like we've slowed enough. And so bottom line is, I think all that we've managed to do is, instead of starting the cuts in December last year, we're likely to start them in September this year. And that's a 10-month delay. But it's still the same cadence that we're going to need, because all the Fed doesn't want to hurt the economy. They simply want to make sure that inflation slows enough so that they don't have a rebound. They don't want inflation to go to 3 and then pick up again. And so they're like, yeah, we have this big chest on the chest of the economy. We'll just keep the weight on. We'll just keep watching. And sooner or later, it will slow inflation down. Because remember this, 3% inflation and 5.5% Fed rates do not jive. That Fed funds rate is too high for the current rate of inflation. It jives with 9%, which is where we were in July 2023, right? So it doesn't jive with 3%. It's still too high of Fed funds rate. And eventually, at some point, I don't know when, it's going to push the economy down and we will get closer to a recession. So I do expect the US economy to slow in the second half of this year. Jobs will go from 300,000 a month to 200,000 a month to 100,000 a month at some point during the year. I don't know when. And that'll give the Fed the room to cut rates. It's just slower to get to their goal, but I don't think the cadence changes.
That's a very interesting take. And you know, there's not a lot that you could kind of pick apart in that, you know, logic. I think we're all kind of sitting here wondering where and what. You know, I give the Fed a lot more credit than a lot of people do. You know, I don't love, you know, the idea that there's...
They were late. They were late, though. And they copped to it, right? They copped to it. That's what I like about the Fed. If they make a mistake, they say we made a mistake.
Well, we're a lot closer to a soft landing, whether we hit it or not, I think, than a lot of people thought a year ago. So still some work to do, you know, but despite all of that, I mean, this is what I keep coming back to. I mean, despite COVID and just the COVID did something to real estate that nothing else has ever done to it, right? Because it's really the first major pandemic in a modern day that we've dealt with. And it created this unbelievable, you know, way that we're looking at real estate differently today, right? A lot of people think COVID had its impact on office, and COVID had its impact on everything.
Yes, on absolutely everything, right? I've never seen this. This has been the greatest black swan event in U.S. history, apart from World War II, which obviously was in a completely different class. But apart from that, I mean, nothing like COVID has ever happened.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone's prepared to say exactly what COVID's done to real estate, because we're still feeling that, right? You know, you still have companies today deciding if they're going back. You still have, and that is not an office building decision. That's one element of it, but the workers, how close they live to the building, what city they live in, what state they live in, you know, this mass exodus from certain states that historically had a lot of labor and a lot. It's just really been interesting, and I think we haven't even seen what, you know, the teenagers that were in high school through COVID, how does this change their behavior and mindset around the way they view real estate and where they live and where they pick to go to school? So much more to come. And then we get out of that black swan and we're kind of like, okay, we somehow, this market, this real estate market, this economy survived COVID, right? And then all of a sudden, interest rates go through the roof, the great resignation, right? You've got all these things and you've got inflation. And then here we are. And while we've seen some areas that have seen some downward pressure, to your point on multifamily, it's downward pressure more on rates than it is on supply demand, which is the normal valuator. So I guess maybe we'll wrap up today with just kind of what do we do here, Neil? What data are we looking at, and how do we make sense of all this? And then lastly, is the resiliency that real estate and the economy have showed, you know, through all of these last 4 years, which has been certainly some ups and downs, can it be any more resilient? Is there anything more than it can come up against? Or is it going to start seeing some chinks in the armor if things don't get back to kind of equilibrium sooner than later?
Well, the piece of data that I want to share with you is this. During COVID, more than 50% of Americans worked from home. That number is now down to the low 20s. Before COVID, it was 8. So 8% of Americans work from home. Now it's 25%. Somewhere in the mid-20s. Depends. Republican states are a little lower than that, and Democrat states are a little bit higher, but they're actually pretty close to each other. Here's the most important piece of information. In the last 6 months, that number has not changed. It is not going anywhere. It was sloping downwards from, you know, its peak in COVID, and then slope, and then it basically flattened out, and it's clearly now the new number. So 8 was the number before COVID, now it's 25. And that fundamentally changes everything about the US economy, because a quarter of Americans now work from home. And that number isn't changing, isn't reducing, right? We hear every once in a while, Google has called people back. Well, you know, Google had mostly called people back anyway. That, you know, big picture, across 333 million Americans, 25% are working from home. And that changes the way that Americans are going to do real estate for the next 50 or 100 years, fundamentally, right? So for example, for years, you know, my brand was built on me currently predicting secondary markets that people would move to, you know, whether it was Phoenix or Nashville or Provo, Utah. You know, I predicted that people would move out of California. California has had, you know, net outward migration in 5 of the last 5 years, so has New York. And so I predicted those smaller markets, and that's what I do. I rank, you know, 323 markets in the US. Now I'm seeing something very interesting. In those markets that people had moved to, they're now moving to smaller markets. So from Phoenix, people are moving to Tucson and Flagstaff. Yeah, from Nashville, people are moving to Knoxville and Chattanooga. So now I'm seeing, because of work from home, people actually stepping to communities that are 500,000 people and have a higher quality of life, lower real estate prices, lower traffic. And so this move, I think, is the next stage, where instead of looking at the biggest market in a state, you now have to look at the second biggest market. There's more money to be made in Idaho Falls than in Boise, Idaho, right? So this is happening in 30 to 40 different cities in the United States that are attracting people from the major market. People are leaving Atlanta, 6 million people, to go to Greenville, South Carolina, right? And so this is happening everywhere. I mean, markets that are secondaries are still attracting people in from the primaries, New York in particular, losing a lot of people to Florida and also to North Carolina. But now within those markets, we are now seeing people move into smaller markets. And that is where the real opportunity for real estate is. Look at the places that are 500,000 to 1 million people and invest in those places, because they're going to be the growth story of the next two decades.
I love wrapping up on that, because it's practical, right? It gives people something to go out and it says, this is what data says, but just go look. And anyone that's close to any of these markets would have to have their eyes closed to not see it, but you don't necessarily think about it in data. And you hit on something that, you know, it's migration from the big to the smaller is not exclusive from the biggest to the next biggest. You know, it's just from whatever gets too big today to the next biggest. And I think if you follow that, you know, kind of carrot all the way down, you can see that from, you know, super small markets. People that want to live in a 100,000 person market have to leave because their 80,000, you know, person market's now 150 and they're out of there. And so it's amazing how we're seeing this. And I can tell you, being in Central Florida, I live in a fairly rural part of Central Florida, about 30 minutes outside of town. And it's not rural anymore. You know, the amount of people, it's the second fastest city in the entire county, because people are willing to go out. And certainly remote work plays such a big factor in that.
It's huge.
You know, and you think about the world that we lived in before. I mean, an hour commute to work was crazy. You know, nobody wanted that unless you had a high paying job and you were, you know, wanted to live in the burbs. But today, if you don't have a commuter, you're only going into the office 1 to 2 days a week. An hour is nothing if you can save 30, 40, 50% on your real estate prices and live, you know, where you want. So wonderful stuff, Neil. Absolutely wonderful.
Well, I'm glad you know, your audience got some nuggets. You know, we present all of this data, we gather it, and we present it twice a year in January and in July in a very interesting, fun presentation called Real Estate Disruptive Trends. And I invite everyone to attend that. It's free. It's always free. We don't have a subscription. We don't have an upsell. You can come and imbibe our data for decades without ever talking with us or having, you know, a conversation with our team. And it's all stored at multifamilyu.com.
What a great resource. Thank you for that. And again, thank you for continuing to be a producer of data and giving the masses access to it and not putting it behind, you know, some lock and key. So, you know, we're in May now. This will probably air end of May, early June. And so you're not too far from that July presentation. Take full advantage of that. Neo, I want to thank you again just for being here. What a great, a lot of fun today. Love talking data, but love talking about how we read that data and where it goes. And we'll certainly look forward to having you back on the show maybe at the end of the year, and we can kind of see, where the data's led us and what story it's telling at that time. Until then, we'll put the Multifamily U and Neil's contact info into the show notes. I'd encourage you to reach out to him. He's a great resource every time we ever chat. He's more than friendly and generous with his time. So thank you for that as well. So we'll definitely get you back on the show. Everybody else, push the like, share, subscribe button. Keep this community growing. Guests like Neil continue to wow and amaze us with their info and insights. So Neil, thanks again for being here. And everybody else, we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope the information within this podcast has given you the tools that you need to find your way to financial independence. We would love to partner with you on this journey. Text ALTS, that's ALTS, to 407-708-1853 to learn more about how to get started today. Don't forget to follow us to make sure you don't miss a second of content, and we'll see you next week.